And this is Forward Forum. I'm John Quinlan.
I'm Stephanie Woods. Woods, welcome to the show.
A wonderful afternoon, April 19th, 2009. We have a fascinating show ahead, something we've been looking forward to for a couple of months now. And the gist of the show will be spent with Matt Rothschild, who's the editor of Progressive Magazine, marking an important landmark here, the 100th anniversary of the magazine in many different ways, with a book, a concert, a conference. And we have some other business we need to get to in just a second, but first I just wanted to welcome Matt Rothschild to Forward Forum.
John, thanks for having me here. It's great to see you.
Good to have you here. So May 1st and 2nd is the conference that all this kind of centers around. How are things going? Are folks signing up?
Yeah, people are signing up. We're real pleased. There have been 400 people who've signed up for the conference already, and we're getting more inquiries all the time.
But it really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity in terms of the caliber of guests you have. And I know, Steph, one of the highlights you're looking forward to.
I'm very excited for the concert. Yes, lots of, I don't know how you guys got all those wonderful artists to join us for this great event, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you've got Tag Evers to thank for that, because
of course,
the concert promoter who put it together. He actually came up with the whole idea, and we thought, oh, we're too busy with this book, the special issue of the magazine, how can we do one more thing? And, you know, he kind of galloped in and said, look, this is what I do, and I know some of these artists. And I'd interviewed Ani DiFranco a couple times.
Yep, I saw that.
And Dar Williams once, and so maybe that helped, but really my hat's off to Tag because he made it all happen.
Yeah, it's going to be a great show. I'm very excited for that. Putting my money in to support this fantastic magazine.
Absolutely. And, actually, that's the other thing to mention. In addition to the book, a very special 100th anniversary edition that is also just so much fun to read. There's still a man on the way in. It must have been some really, well, I'll put it to you, there must have been some really difficult choices trying to distill down 100 years of history this way.
Yeah, we went through all 100 volumes of the Progressive every year. I can't tell you that we read every single word, but we did turn every single page.
Yeah.
And we looked for gems to fall out, and there were just so many of them. And we polished them up and put them together, and there was always not enough space for everything we wanted in the book and everything we wanted in the magazine. So those final selections were really painful.
I imagine
so. Well, speaking of a show we're looking forward to, this one is it. And we welcome your calls. Please join in our conversation about 100 years of progressive history. But before we get started with Matt, we did want to bring another guest in who actually will be making an appearance here in Madison later this week. And that is Stephen Ashby. He's the author of a book called Staley, The Fight for a New American Labor Movement. Stephen, welcome to Forward Forum.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. And as we explained, unfortunately, we're a bit short on time because we've got so much to cover in terms of 100 years of progressive history. But it sounds like just a fascinating presentation, a really interesting book. And we want to make sure our listeners know that there are a couple of opportunities to hear you speak about this experience. We'll get to that in just a second, but before we do that, could you just give us sort of a capsule summary of what Staley is, what the labor struggle is that you're discovering, the time frame and place?
Well, this is one of the most important labor struggles of the last 25 years. It happened in Decatur, Illinois in the mid-90s. And it's a story about labor transforming itself, about workers in a small local union, uninvolved, apathetic kind of membership, who transformed their local when their company destroyed their contract, and they waged this three-year battle. They went from 20 people coming to monthly meetings to 800 to 1,000 coming to weekly meetings.
Wow.
They increased their dues from $18 a month to $100 a month to pay for this national campaign. They sent scores of people on the road called Road Warriors, and built solidarity committees in dozens of cities, just inspired tens of thousands of people. I headed the Chicago Solidarity Committee, and it was just an incredible time.
One of the things that strikes me in reading about it is it sounds like it was just a classic case of coalition building in action.
It was. You know, they reached out in their own community to the clergy. Father Mangan in Decatur really became one of the main spokespersons for the struggle. The African-American workers overcome a lot of racism that existed in the plant, became leading fighters, and a real national coalition, too, and a national corporate campaign. So it's all about what they did through their voices. We tried to write it kind of novelistic, very accessible to people, but it's about how labor has to change itself. So it fits in very well with the progressive celebration about how we need social change in this country, how we can make it happen.
No, it sure does. As we go forward into our interview with Matt, again, I apologize, Stephen, for short shrift. We will get you back on the show before too long here. But what are your projections for the future of labor at a time of economic downturn? Why is the role of labor so important?
Well, labor is, of course, the main anti-poverty device in the country. The labor movement is so important, as important as the women's movement and civil rights movement were in the 60s and 70s. And we've seen, as labor has declined over the last 20 years, we've seen workers' wages and standard of living decline. So it's more important than ever in this economic crisis that workers organize collectively and demand to be treated with dignity and respect on the job and get decent wages. You know, I mean, people are finally furious at Wall Street with good reason. We just need to turn that into organizing, turn the country around. So I'm very hopeful about the future of the labor movement. I hope we, telling the story of the workers, can help rebuild and strengthen and revitalize the labor movement. I mean, there are chapters on civil disobedience and solidarity committees and work to rule and implant campaign that really aren't in any other book. I try to be immodest when you're telling a book, but I think if you read one book about workers' rights or the labor movement this year, I hope you'll choose Staley.
Well, it sounds like, you know, again, not that a book has to equal these cinematic things, but, you know, in the style of a Norma Ray or just a very inspiring story about the difference that people can make.
It really is.
All right. Hey, Stephen, thanks so much for joining us again. Thanks again. And
and also, just to mention,
yes.
Staleybook.org is our website. We have photos from the struggle, documents, the union's newsletter. Staleybook.org.
Thanks again. Take care and safe travels.
Thank you.
All right. And again, this is Forward Forum. John Quinlan here with
Stephanie Woods.
And we are looking forward to an hour's conversation with Matt Rothschild. Hey, Steph, if you don't mind, could you tune up track 8 as we go into this? What I've tried to do is we'll do just a few of these because we got plenty to talk about. But
the first thing is to
trying to
remember
if you could. I think she played up right away, but we'll get her in a second. Just to highlight some of the speakers and some of the folks that you mentioned in the book, and in this case, kind of an interesting observation from an interview Bill Moyers did a couple years ago with Barbara Ehrenreich, who is one of the speakers, I believe.
The first thing is to remember that there are, you know, ways of people can of making change by working together. You know, we sort of lose that idea. Yet this American culture has been full of wonderful examples of people working together, collectively is the old word, to make change. The civil rights movement wasn't just a couple of, you know, superstars like Martin Luther King. It was thousands and thousands, millions, I should say, of people taking risks, becoming leaders in their community. The women's movement. And it wasn't only Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan. It was, again, millions of women coming together and saying, we're going to make change here. We're going to march. We're going to demand different legislation.
And, Matt, part of the reason I brought this into it, something I know that you feel very deeply, too. When we talk about, history, very often it is that we bring up kind of the superstars or the folks that have come to the top that are mentioned all the time. But I mean, an important part of the history you're commemorating as well are those grassroots efforts. And, you know, if folks feel that they're only there to honor the accomplishments of others, that's just not the case because they have a stake in this heritage and what we do going forward as well.
Yeah, one of the things we do in the Progressive Month In and Month Out, John, is we have an on-the-line section. We devote 4 pages of the Progressive to activism around the country. People who don't have big names but are out there, they have big courage.
Yeah.
They're out there with their signs and they're protesting, as Stephen was talking about, for union rights, or they're protesting for gay rights and marriage equality, or they're protesting against globalization, or they're protesting for peace and against the, you know, nuclear arms race, or they're protesting, you know, to change our policy toward Cuba, or whatever it is. I mean, we understand that that's how social change happens. I mean, we're kind of disciples of Howard Zinn, the great American historian who wrote People's History of the United States, and he tells us that more important than the leaders, just as Barbara Ehrenreich was talking about, are the people at the grassroots who are pushing those leaders forward. And so we try to focus on those people every month at the same time that we also try to get some of the best writers in the country to write for us.
And if you look at the programming for that conference on May 1st and 2nd, it's a whole range of folks. It's folks that will be very, hot to people's minds right away in terms of folks that have been very prominent, but it's also folks working in the grassroots.
Yeah, and the woman who's the executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force is going to be here,
Excellent.
Rhea Carey. I've never met her before. I'm anxious to meet her. I mean, Irva Shivad, a long time ago, had that position. I know Irva Shivad, but I don't know her successors. And so I'm interested in meeting her and hearing what she has to say. It's just, it is important for people to work together. And that's why here in Madison, whenever there's a protest, I try to get there as much as possible. I had fun walking just around the Capitol and to some legislators' offices a couple months ago when we were protesting the Israeli invasion of Gaza. And, you know, it wasn't a beautiful day. You know, we were just out there to show that we disapprove of this policy. And it's those kinds of actions over time that have really given us the kind of progress we've achieved in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking back through this 100 years of the progressive, there was child labor when we started. You know, there wasn't an eight-hour day. There wasn't a minimum wage. Women didn't have the right to vote. Jim Crow is still around. I mean, all those changes that we've made and all those issues have been the result of concerted collective action of outraged citizens who understand that America wasn't living up to its promise.
Yeah. Let me just mention the Irvishi's stream of thought's going to happen a lot this hour, but Irvishi's life partner, Kate Clinton, is going to be our guest sometime in May, but she's also a regular contributor to the Progressive Magazine.
Regular contributor, and she's in this book, this collection that we have here called Democracy in Print, The Best of the Progressive Magazine. Actually, there's an interview with Irva Shivad, and there's Kate Clinton writing about gay marriage.
All right. Steph, what stood out for you about this book?
I really enjoyed, I'm curious as to how you guys picked, looking at the contents in the beginning here, all these topics that you have, how you selected each of these stories. There's so much writing that goes into the magazine. I'm curious what decided that something would make it in and something that wouldn't.
Well, Steph, we were looking for writing that stood the test of time. We were looking for writing that was really strong and pithy, because we couldn't run the whole article either most of the time. I mean, some of the articles here, they were obvious takes. I mean, James Baldwin's letter to my nephew that he wrote early in the 1960s to his nephew, who was also named James, where he says, basically, this society hates you. This society wants you to fail, and they're going to do everything in their power to make you fail. I mean, that is a much anthologized piece of writing, so that was a gimme. That was a no-brainer. But some of the other ones, it was just kind of fun to find some of these pieces that fell out of the magazine when we opened it up, like Carl Sandburg. You know, Carl Sandburg was a big name poet, Chicago poet, but he had this little essay about having a daughter. When his wife had their first daughter, he wrote something called My Baby Girl. He was delighted to have the newborn, but within a day of his daughter's birth, all his friends were saying, too bad it's a girl. And he wrote this essay to say, no, it's not too bad it's a girl. I'm delighted it's a girl. She's wonderful, and she will live to see the day where women have the right to vote and when women will be in the House of Representatives. So don't tell me too bad it's a girl. And it was just, that was one of the funnest parts of this job, going through the back issues. And when we went back through all of them, just finding things that were unexpected. I knew I was going to find James Baldwin because I'd read it several times. I knew I was going to find Martin Luther King Jr. in there, or Edward Said or Molly Ivins. But I didn't know Carl Sandburg on women's suffrage was going to be in there.
Wow.
I didn't know that, you know, Belle Case La Follette herself was such a tremendous person, not only for suffrage. She was an incredible suffragist, and The Progressive was a suffragist magazine for the first 11 years until women got the right to vote. But she was courageous on civil rights for African Americans, too. She went to bat in Washington, D.C. when blacks were being discriminated against in the bureaucracy. She wrote letters to the President of the United States to say, look into this claim of discrimination, we can't stand for it. And so seeing that kind of bravery on the part of the writers and the editors in here was really, really heartening and humbling.
I'm glad that you bring up women and kids. Women have a whole section on this book, and being a woman myself, that's the part that I really enjoyed. So many stories, the one about the patriotic prostitute. What I especially liked was the interview with Gloria Steinem. She says something in here that just really stopped me. That I wanted to share. I'm really glad that you guys picked this. She says, we need to know in our hearts that men can raise children just as well as women can, and we need to be willing to raise our boys to raise children. We've done something towards raising our daughters more like our sons, but fewer of us have had the courage to raise our sons more like our daughters, and that's very, very important. I just kind of put the book down and stood back and thought, this is great. Why did you guys choose to put this one in there?
Well, because it's a really heavy thought, isn't it? I mean,
it's
kind of an intense philosophical claim there, which is accurate. And also, you know, she's getting to, you know, how we stereotype people at a very early age. in the society, just as Carl Sandburg was too, mm-hmm. and saying, look, we don't need to do it that way, and we shouldn't do it that way, and we should let our kids be who they want to be and who they are, rather than forcing them into these little cubby holes. And I thought that was wonderful.
Just out of curiosity, you know, we were just talking about your son ahead of the show, who's the same age as my niece Sol. And is that something that is in the back of your head, some of the wisdom of these women as you raise him?
Well, I try to carry it with me. I mean, I have three very different children, and my daughter wants to be a doctor, and my son's a waiter in town, and my other son wants to be a football player. I mean, they're all kind of
run
all over
gamut.
The map, and that's wonderful. And I guess that's what you're saying, Steph. That's mm-hmm. what Gloria Steinem was saying in this interview that's so heartening.
Yeah. Again, this is Forward Forum here on Madison 1670 WTDY. Our guest is Matt Rothschild. We're talking about a series of events around the 100th anniversary of the Progressive Magazine, including a great book called Democracy in Print, The Best of the Progressive Magazine. We welcome your calls, 321-1670. You know, as you were talking about James Baldwin, I've had a chance recently returned to school, mostly studying things about civil rights, the women's rights movement, and other things. Had a chance to write a paper on James Baldwin. And you're right, that letter that he writes to his nephew is just incredible. I think that the quality that it has that's true of so many other pieces in here, as much as this is an overused term, is its authenticity. He gets it. He understands it. He's not trying to spin something. He is presenting the way that it is, and trusting that his audience can take the truth and will act on that truth.
You know, John, it's interesting that you used the word authenticity and that you seized on this essay, too, because one of the things that struck the editors as we were going through and we saw how many of these essays were in the first person that we liked so mm-hmm. much, or how many of the interviews stood up, just because it was a human being standing on his or her own 2 feet and saying, you know, this is what we need to do, this is how this issue has affected me, rather than a highfalutin or theoretical leftist discourse or pontificating.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a real sense of immediacy, a sense of urgency, and a sense of human drama and a lot of the writing in here.
Yeah. Well, just with that in mind, Steph, actually, can we do another clip? Let's see. This would be, sorry, number 7, please. This is a clip from Dr. King and his Beyond Vietnam speech, which occurred on April 4th, 42 years ago. And it's kind of an interesting, anyway, we'll let it speak for itself.
We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
Matt, it's one of my favorite speeches that he makes, and he's actually very introspective as he begins, because going into this, I think a lot of folks really wanted to box Dr. King in and say, you are a black civil rights leader, but how dare you begin to venture into the territory of Vietnam or colonialism or materialism or these other things. And yet again, that's this current that seems to go through every prominent progressive that you're quoting from, that they always saw the big picture. They saw these interconnections.
And their conscience won't let them get away with silence, because this is 1967. Martin Luther King Jr. Was kind of late to the dance against the Vietnam War for the very reasons you're suggesting. They were going to lose support. He knew he was going to lose support among white Americans who were, you know, in favor of the war and thought he should be in his place. If his place isn't, you know, an inferior person, which they thought for 400 years, at least his place was just in that civil rights box, and he refused to stay in the box. And the things he pointed to there, the triplets, racism, extreme materialism, militarism, those are three of the main themes that the progressive has been talking about now for 100 years.
You know, and the more things change, the more they stay the same. Elsewhere in that same speech, he talks about how there was this shining moment, I think maybe 64, 65, where they were about to launch these massive anti-poverty programs. The government was going to be committed to do this, but because of all of the costs that went into waging an unjust war, suddenly that wasn't going to happen anymore. I mean, flash forward to right now. That's pretty similar to what's happening now.
This, I think of the two issues that motivated the founder of the Progressive, Robert La Follette, those two would be fighting corporate power and fighting empire, that the United States can't be an empire and still take care of people here at home in the way they need to be taken care of. And in that speech, Martin Luther King Jr. is addressing both of those issues in the most compelling way. It's one of my favorite speeches of all time.
And again, this is Forward Forum. We are speaking with Matt Rothschild, and among many hats he's wearing today is he's the author of Democracy in Print, the best of Progressive magazine, also helped to edit and put together a very special 100th anniversary edition of Progressive magazine. Conference coming up May 1st and 2nd that is going to bring some really remarkable speakers and activists together, both folks you've heard of and folks who are working on the ground that you want to meet. And then one other highlight that you're looking
forward
to.
The concert at the Orpheum on April 30th.
Ani DeFranco, Dar Williams, Indigo Girls. I mean, it's going to be just a tremendous concert.
Melissa Farrick. It's just going to be a great night. We will come back in just a moment. You're listening to Forward Forum.
Back to Forward Forum. Times, they are indeed changing, although as we get further into this discussion, we find all these resonances, all of these lessons of history that need to be remembered. It's one of the most important things to do when you have this great opportunity to look back on 100 years of progressive thought. Again, Matt Rothschild, the editor of Progressive Magazine, is here. Highlight again those great ways that we're marking this this important date. Democracy in Print, the best of the Progressive magazine, 1909 to 2009, is now on the bookshelves. Also, you can take a look at a very special issue of Progressive magazine. Steph, I know you have that in hand, and that is so exciting because
it's done by year.
Yeah, and just brings out these pithy, you know, incredible highlights by people who made that history. And then also coming up on April 30th at the Orpheum is a wonderful concert. Who are some of those headliners you were mentioning, Steph, that really...
Ooh, let me tell you. Ani DeFranco, one of my favorites. The Indigo Girls, too. Dar Williams, Melissa Farrick. A Hamill on Trial. I'm not familiar with that band, but I'm sure compared to the rest of the folks that are going to be there, it's going to be nothing less than brilliant on April 30th at the Orpheum.
And then May 1st and 2nd, a conference bringing in... some incredible people from all different corners of the country in terms of leadership in the area of all of this. Robert Redford, a keynoter, many of the progressive elected reps, including our own Senator Russ Feingold, Representative Tammy Baldwin, Howard Zinn, Cindy Sheehan, Jim Hightower, Barbara Ehrenreich, Katrina VandenHeuvel from The Nation, Chuck D., Senator George McGovern, John Nichols, Bob McChesney, Adolf Reed, Martin Espada, Michael Feldman, Susan Douglas, David Zirin, Will Durst, Ruth Conniff, Elizabeth D. Novella from the Progressive, along with Ruth, and Amadi Paul, also from the Progressive, and Matt. Many, many more. So, in a nutshell.
Raising the roof of Monona Terrace there, if it's nice.
That is a deal.
We'll be inside.
All right. That is a deal.
And it's progressive.org for finding out about all of this. Something I wanted to make sure, an important piece of this history that I remember, and it was one of the things that I think motivated me to explore journalism and activism, for that matter, myself, and that was developments that played out in 1979. And do you remember this history, Steph? I don't know if you
I was four.
In school. No, I'm curious if since you studied comm arts and some other things, I wonder, you know, if they're still teaching this, because I've had it in a couple of my classes.
I don't remember, John. I hate to admit that, but
That's
I don't remember if they taught that or not. I hope they did.
Maybe you didn't take that broadcast law class
that
dwelled on this. But anyway, what happened back then is that the progressive was really at the center of one of the the landmark decisions in terms of our Constitution, First Amendment rights. Matt, can you take it from there?
Sure. And the guy who wrote the article, Howard Moreland, is going to be at the conference.
Oh,
he's going to be on a panel about the peace movement and stopping the nuclear arms race on Friday, May 1st at Monona Terrace. So that'll be fun to reconnect with Howard Moreland. Yeah, this was a as you say, John, a landmark case in First Amendment rights in this country. The Progressive got a story, the H-bomb secret. We discovered how the H-bomb worked, and Howard Moreland did, that is, simply by going to public sources, to libraries and talking to scientists. And his point was, look, there really isn't a secret. That any foreign country that wants to find out about how to make an H-bomb, they'll be able to find it out. The scientific knowledge cannot be put back into the bottle. And we're fooling ourselves if we think we can save ourselves simply by stamping top secret all over the material relating to the H-bomb, and that the only way we can make ourselves safe is by getting rid of these nuclear weapons. So that's why he wanted to unveil this nuclear secret and why Irwin Knoll, the editor at the time, wanted to publish it. And what happened was the federal government for 6 months put a gag in the Progressive's mouth and would not let us publish that article. It was an unprecedented prior restraint on publication, which is unconstitutional. And only after the Madison Press Connection at that time disclosed a bit of the essence of the story did the court case become moot, and the Progressive then was able to go and publish in November 1979 the whole story. So Irwin Knoll writes about that H-bomb case in great detail in our anthology, Democracy in Print. And by the way, I want to thank the UW Press for publishing it. University of Wisconsin Press really came to our rescue and published this book at a time of need when our first publisher fell through. And they rode in to the rescue. So I'm forever grateful to them. And Howard Moreland, I had a different take on it. He wasn't so much a First Amendment guy. He was a peace guy. He was an anti-nuclear guy. So, I mean, Irwin, and he shared some of this, but his emphasis really was on stopping the arms race. Irwin, who was a journalist by trade since he was a high school editor in New York City and then was at the Washington Post, he didn't want the government to be able to tell anybody what to say, much less a magazine or a newspaper what to say. So they had there was a little tension there always. But reading the story is fascinating. Reading the original story by Howard Moreland, reading Irwin Knoll's account of it, is gripping because at one point the attorney for the Progressive, Gordon Sinekin, who was at La Follette Sinekin Law Firm, now La Follette Godfrey and Kahn, called up Irwin and said, you know, there's this Atomic Energy Act in 1954, and it used to have the death penalty for releasing secrets on nuclear weapons, but fortunately for you, the death penalty no longer applies. But he could have, Irwin and Howard Moreland could have been in jail for many, many years.
Well, it was such an important line in the sand to draw, and you wonder how history might have been different if that had that you hadn't succeeded as Progressive Magazine in doing what you did, because that justification is always there. We've got to keep this secret. We can't talk about this because of national security. And how many times has that been used as a justification for going around the public?
Well, and we just saw with Bush Cheney. I mean, they wanted some of those memos that came out, not these torture memos, but memos from about a month ago came out, said they wanted to suspend the First Amendment during the war on terror. I mean, that's how anti-democratic they were. And so Irwin had a lot of courage there. He said, you know, we're not in the business of being in business. He didn't, because the Progressive could have gone out of business. And when he was confronted with that by people say, why are you risking the Progressive? He said, we're in the business for telling the truth and trying to make this country a better place. And if we go out of business, we go out of business. But we're going to fight this fight.
I want to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Sure.
Matt, do you ever feel like you guys are preaching to the converted? Because that's something that I argue with my father all the time, and I want to give him, you know, I definitely want to give him this book and have him read it, but I know he won't, and he's also not the converted. Do you feel like you are?
Yes, yes and no. I think it's important to preach the converted. I think the converted need to be inspired.
Choir needs practice, too. I mean,
also,
I need to take them in a word, but yeah.
Not so much to keep them in tune, but to keep their spirits up, because it can be so discouraging. I mean, look back at those Bush Cheney years, how dispiriting it was. And if we didn't have magazines like The Progressive saying, first of all, you're not alone. There are a lot of other people who believe the same way you do. Plus, you're right for the following reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have just, you know, cashed in your chips and said, forget it, I'm not going to do politics anymore, it's useless. And we try to take the long historical view and to show people that it's not useless. So I think it's important to preach to the converted. It also is important, as your father's suggesting, I think, Steph, to get to people who don't already agree with you.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I like going on radio mm-hmm. is because radio is it's open. It's an open forum. Anyone turning the dial, putting the search thing on the radio there in the car, the scan, they can, you know, if they find someone who's talking in an interesting way, maybe they'll stop and take a listen whether they agree with us or not. And that's one way to get to other people. Getting on the internet is another way to get to other people. We have something called the Progressive Media Project, where we send out four or five op-ed commentaries to mainstream newspapers every week. That's a way of getting the word out there. So I think your father has a point, but I think we're trying to address that point.
That's a perfect segue to make that pitch again for you to join our conversation, whether progressive, conservative, libertarian, wherever you fall on the spectrum, if you fall on a spectrum at all. You know, and Steph, you know, it's a great point to bring up, and it's really legitimate. But it also speaks to, I think, what we also face as progressives, as a progressive movement, that so many people in this book, in the magazine, who will be speaking at the conference, have managed to transcend. And that's these pervasive messages from the so-called mainstream or the Karl Roves of the world or everything. They're trying to marginalize us, trying to feel like what we have to say is on the fringes. It's not really relevant to the mainstream discourse. And it's just example in here of people overcoming that. And of course, you know, you've talked recently, the extremes of that kind of tactic, blacklisting and, you know, basically trying to squelch speech are coming back all too much. So we got to claim the mantle, I think, and not feel like we're preaching to the choir, because our message really does, we have things to say to everybody. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and one of the things Paul Wellstone says in the end of this book here, Wellstone came to our 90th anniversary, so it's kind of sad to invoke his name for our 100th, because he had that terrible fatal car crash in between. I mean, he talks about progressive values being majority values, and they are. People want universal health care. People want an increase in the minimum wage. People want to spend money to preserve our environment. People recognize that big business, like 80% of the American public, think big business has too much power, not only over our economy, but over our political system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are majority progressive views. And not everyone. I mean, marriage equality is coming around, but you keep looking at the polls, it's getting better and better.
Yeah.
You look what happened in Iowa, what happened in Vermont, what's going to happen in New York probably. I mean, we've come, you know, miles on that issue, and on a lot of the just bread and butter progressive issues, the people are with us.
Steph, could you cue up track 5? What I wanted to introduce into the conversation, too, was just another theme that stood out to me. Again, you know, this is as a history major, somebody who just loves studying, especially political history, you know, why it's important for everybody to understand. Otherwise, we have things that are homogenized, meanings that are allowed to stand that just don't really reflect the reality of what happened. And what I wanted to play was a brief clip of Noam Chomsky. This is, I think, circa 1967 in a debate with William F. Buckley. This is over kind of what the Cold War was all about. Noam Chomsky.
It's perfectly true that there were areas of the world, in particular Eastern Europe, where Stalinist imperialism very brutally took control and still maintains control. But there are also very vast areas of the world where we were doing the same thing. And there's quite an interplay in the Cold War. You see, what you just described is I believe, a mythology about the Cold War, which might have been tenable 10 years ago, but which is quite inconsistent with contemporary scholarship.
Ask a Czech.
Ask a Guatemalan, ask a Dominican, ask a person from the Dominican Republic, ask a person from South Vietnam, you know, ask a Thai.
Obviously, we can't get away if you can't distinguish between the nature of our venture in Guatemala and the nature of the Soviet Union's in Prague. We have real difficulty.
So, you know, for that person who thinks, hey, the Cold War was all about a victorious United States purveyor of democracy and having nothing but altruistic values for the rest of the world, you got to kind of question that analysis a little bit when you listen to a Noam Chomsky.
Well, yeah, and Noam Chomsky was making the example of U.S. interventions in Guatemala, U.S. interventions in the Dominican Republic,
yeah.
U.S. obviously interventions in Vietnam. And we have a chapter in our book called Democracy in Print, and the chapter is Renouncing Empire, where La Follette is talking about, you know, why are we, or La Follette's son is talking about why are we invading Nicaragua in 1927. And there were other things about, you know, why is President Wilson, you know, sending troops to Haiti in the 19-teens?
Yeah.
I mean, so you can just see this thread go all the way through U.S. history, and we try to pull on that thread a little bit in Democracy in Print and also in our April issue, which is a, a compendium of the 100 years. We devote one single page to each year. We went through, you know, each volume and culled the best and cut them really down to size. So it's just the magazine itself is a walk through U.S. history, a walk through U.S. progressive history. It's a bunch of appetizers. If you want the full meal, you should get the book, Democracy in Print. But they're arranged differently. Democracy in Print is done thematically, and the magazine is done chronologically.
What I'm finding humorous here is that history, as we all know, repeats itself. Back in 1923, you've got an article here from Robert La Follette saying, "We will not endure a king." And then back here in the Democracy in Print book, we've got Senator Russ Feingold saying, "The president is not a king and no one is above the law. I yield the floor." And this was talking about the speech was delivered on the floor February 7th, 2006, talking about the president giving his State of the Union, where he spoke of America's leadership in the world and called on all of us to lead this world toward freedom.
It's a great catch.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Stephanie, it's great that you put those two together because we wanted people to put those two together. Not everyone has. Feingold was talking about the warrantless wiretapping, and Bush was saying, was talking about it, and it was patently illegal what he was doing, and Congress standing up and clapping, and Feingold said, "Why in the world are you guys clapping for this? You know, we're not subjects. We're not court jesters. He's not a king. We should hold the president to the law," and that's just what La Follette himself was saying when he said, "We will not endure a king," back in 1923. The echoes bounce all over these pages, and that's one of the more fascinating things
about it. Sometimes
it's taunting and depressing because we haven't gained much ground like there, and sometimes it's exhilarating when you see the progress that has been made for civil rights, for instance, for African Americans, the women's movement, the gay rights movement. That's a little happier. But the question of health care, for instance, we don't have it. The question of war and
healthcare.
Civil liberties, that's still a fight.
Getting started on the healthcare.
Just a quick aside, my favorite historical residence is the same guy saying essentially the same thing 40 years later, Strom Thurmond, on why blacks don't belong in the military in 1948 and making the same arguments for gays in the military, you know, back more recent years. So
eye roll. Oh, geez. Well, you're listening to Forward Forum. We are speaking with Matt Rothschild, the editor of Democracy in Print, this fantastic
anthology,
that's the word I was looking for, the best of the
opinion.
Progressive magazine, 1909 to 2009, that's 100 years, and we'll be back with more. Your call's right here if you'd like to talk to Matt, back in a minute.
Step by step, the longest march can be won, many stones to form an arch. Singly none, and by union what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none,
You're listening to, who is this, John?
That's Sweet Honey and the Rock.
Sweet Honey and the Rock. And this is Forward Forum, and we are so happy to have Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, with us today. We're celebrating the 100th anniversary with a series of exciting things happening, lots of events. We've got this new book, Democracy in Print, the best of the Progressive, 1909 to 2009. That's 100 years. There's also a concert coming up at the Orpheum, April 30th. And then we also have, and I'm missing my information here, on the conference.
Conference is May 1st and 2nd at the Monona Terrace Convention Center.
Amy Goodman and Jesse Jackson on the rooftop of Monona Terrace. That's going to be a lot of fun. Michael Feldman's going to be there, the poet Martina Spada, Tony Castaneda, DJ Trini. It's going to be kind of a party with Jesse Jackson and Amy Goodman.
So
and a cash bar, too.
Well worth it.
You can't go wrong.
You'll be in a mellow mood. But anyway, really great opportunities coming up in a little more than a couple weeks out here. And we wanted to I did want to, before the end of the hour, also bring in someone who was a longtime contributor to the Progressive magazine, who is very much missed, and that is Molly Ivins.
The drawback, of course, is that there are no gatekeepers. There is nobody making sure that the information on the Internet is accurate, factually accurate. And it pains me as a journalist to see some of the results, because I think that when you put bad information into the public debate, it's like poisoning the well of democracy. And I have hated editors all my life. I am obviously opposed to censorship of any kind. I suspect the Internet is going to have to sort itself out on its own as far as its reliability at various sites. But I am very hopeful that that new technology is going to make a tremendous difference. And in the meantime, it's incredibly important to keep the small, independent voices alive. It really is.
Again, that was a speech by Molly Iwins. I believe it's at Tulane University back in 2004. Molly passed away in January of 2007. And we both speak to her point about the future of journalism, but also what your remembrances of Molly Iwins.
Well, she was just a larger than life figure. She was that was Molly at her most serious, but I remember her as a person with an incredible sense of humor and a very salty one at that. I mean, we have a quote from her from 1998 in the middle of the Monica Lewinsky crisis, where she says, "With all due respect to the president's private parts, we do have bigger problems in this country." And that's typical, more typical of Molly Iwins.
Yes.
But I laughed when she said she's hated editors all over, I've got to say. She is sorely missed, John, as you say. And she was a champion her whole life of small independent voices. She wrote not only for The Progressive, she wrote for The Nation. She was an editor and then on the board of the Texas Observer. So we miss her greatly. I want to just mention one other person who was instrumental in these collections, and that is our culture editor at The Progressive, Liz DiNovella. She went through a lot of these years and helped me select and trim down the offerings.
Absolutely.
Couldn't have done it without her.
Can you just highlight for folks some of the other columnists who've written for you over the years? One discovery we made recently is we had a woman named Adrienne Torf on. Adrienne collaborated with June Jordan, African-American woman who was just extraordinary. Discovered that she came to Madison, and I imagine that was to teach for a year. Was that the point where she started writing for you?
Well, that's how I found out about her, and I got to thank my wife for that, June, because she said June Jordan, poet, will be speaking at Helen C. White, and she put that notice up on our fridge, and I didn't, in my ignorance, know who June Jordan was, and I saw the notice that Gene had left on the fridge, so I took myself there and took my little reporter's pad, and I was totally blown away, so much so that I couldn't leave without buying her books that were on sale in the hallway, and I read one of those books that morning before I went in the office that evening, and then the next morning, and I said to Irwin Knoll, who was editor then, I was just a junior editor, I said, "We got to get this woman in The Progressive." And we did. She was an incredibly powerful voice for economic justice, for racial justice, for sexual justice, and she was one of the best writers we've ever had, and it was very intimate to edit her things because she sent it handwritten over a fax machine, almost illegible.
Oh, that's
so
great.
I had to decipher what she was saying before I could just type it up to the computer, and it was wonderful. She was a real force.
That's an artist, that's for sure. Hey, one other person that I remember because of personal connection, actually a father and son team, John Edgerton, and I think in later years his son Brooks, who had been an editor to the Cap Times, but John grew up in Nashville, was kind of an historian of the South, a white civil rights leader who just wrote some very powerful stuff. Brooks later moved to Madison, also a great investigative reporter, someone who was a gay community leader.
And both of them wrote for The Progressive.
Exactly.
So that was kind of a nice thing to see going back. John Edgerton even went to interview James Earl Ray in jail.
Yeah.
We didn't put that in either of these 100th anniversary anthologies, but it was an incredible story in itself. It's not like James Earl Ray was saying totally drastically different things than he said his whole life, but John Edgerton was a champion of civil liberties. He also was an editor of a cooking magazine or a cookbook in the South.
Yep, Brooks gave me that for my birthday one year.
Kind of a long reach and a wonderful man, and Brooks is a wonderful person.
Incidentally, food is a great way to understand history, for that matter. He really brought that home. Yes, Steph?
I'm curious, Matt, with the way things are going for print, where do you see magazines, The Progressive, in the future?
Well, I think magazines are going to be more like books, and I think people will be reading books 10, 20, 50 years from now.
I don't think
people will be reading newspapers very much.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Obama said at his press conference yesterday, we're going to know that already, and we're not going to need to read the newspaper. But we are going to need to read magazines that can say, where is the Obama administration going in general, or to do investigative reporting, and to look at the news from a higher altitude than the daily newspaper, because dailies are dying. We're seeing their corpses everywhere in the street right now. But magazines and books, I think people are going to still want to have around. And plus, rather than the internet conveyor belt of one piece of news after another just whips by and you can barely distinguish one from another and then it's gone,
mm-hmm.
you want something that is more durable, that is more eternal in a magazine or in a book that can say, you know, a lot of news has passed under the bridge in the last month or so. Here's what's really important, and here's a different way of looking at it, or here's a different voice for it.
Just time flying by. We're about a two-minute warning, but I don't know if you read the piece that Bob McChesney, John Nichols wrote about the plight of the daily newspaper. One of the things that they advocated for is perhaps both a return to nonprofit journalism, but also potentially role of the government in sustaining journalism. Do you think either of those are doable ideas?
A lot of governments in Western Europe, subsidize the media in a way that ours doesn't. So that is a possible solution, too.
Of course, at the beginning of the Republic, the government paid for postage, other things to sustain those small publications.
Yeah, I just don't know if there's time to change the policy before these newspapers die in front of our very eyes, though. But I think magazines will live, and I think books will live. The progressive will live.
With just about a minute left, what's your vision of the future, to the extent that you can share it with us? We just come through an election cycle where young people seem to be energized in a way that they haven't been in a long time. Is that something you see? Is that something you're optimistic about?
I think there's a real moment here, a promising moment for progressive politics. I mean, Obama brought a lot of people to politics that weren't there before, but they weren't there just to support Obama. They were there because they wanted to take a stride for racial equality in this country and to get past the Bush-Cheney real reactionary regime. And now we need to be both supportive and critical of Obama, supportive of him when he's doing the right thing, critical when he's departing from progressive principle or letting the torturers off the hook like he did last week. So that's more difficult, nuanced stance, but it's a stance we've got to take.
And what advice would you give to a young person contemplating a career in journalism these days?
Well, I would go into journalism. There's ways to practice journalism that are going to be here. It's just that I don't think print is the way. Learn how to work on the web. That's going to be here.
That's
okay.
A great point.
Again, our guest has been Matt Rothschild. Let's get that basic information out again. The book is Democracy in Print, the best of the Progressive Magazine. A special edition of the Progressive Magazine out on the stands now. Conference coming up May 1st and 2nd at Monona Terrace. And a special concert April 30th at the Orpheum. I think we're getting most of it. Progressive.org.
Yeah, not progressive.com. That gets you auto insurance. You want to go to progressive.org.
Right. Is there a phone number people can use just in case?
Yeah, 9 to 5. Get us at 257-4626 or stop by at 409 East Main Street.
Matt Rothschild, thanks so much. John Quinlan with Stephanie Wins. We'll see you next week.